Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and today I'm going to talk about the politics of national service in Great Britain between 1945 and 1949. I'm working from the brilliant book National Service by Richard Vinen, and the reason why I want to talk about this is because national service, the conscription of young British men into the army, was really a kind of a historical anomaly, and of course the compulsory service of British women into the Women's Army Corps, the Wrens, and the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. The use of conscription in European countries is a fairly standard feature of the modern era, and national service is seen still in countries like France and Germany as being pretty standard. In Britain, it was never really considered either a necessity or something that was supposed to have social benefits. The reason why it hasn't been considered to be a necessity is because of Britain's island status, the ability of Britain to protect itself with a large navy, and the unlikelihood of Britain being invaded. European nations with land borders always face this possibility, and so since the French Revolution, mass civilian population mobilisation, the levy en masse, has been a key feature, not just in France, but in nearly every other major European state. And the social and political ideas behind national service are in some parts of Europe to draw people into the idea of the nation, to draw people into the idea of the patrie, the fatherland, to sacrifice and serve on the behalf of the nation, and to help shape notions of national identity, service and sacrifice. And also there are all sorts of kind of psychological and gender-based ideas about making a man of you, trying to take people with kind of lawless or offending behaviour and straighten them out through strict tough army discipline, all these sorts of ideas. There was very little of that actually motivating British post-war conscription. Most British post-war conscription was motivated by Britain's immediate military realities. So in 1945, Britain's overseas military commitments didn't end. If anything, they actually escalated with the creation of new Cold War conditions, the need of British soldiers to be in Palestine, in Greece, in Malaya or Hong Kong or Singapore or a whole variety of other places develops as the new world of Cold War anxieties and tensions also develops. So I'm going to read now from The Politics of Conscription, which is Chapter 3 of Richard Vinen's National Service, and he writes, "Constraint was the basis of national service, and this was true of the country as much as it was for the men who turned up for basic training. Politicians did not introduce peacetime conscription because they thought it was would do young men good. Anthony Eden, the Conservative shadow foreign secretary, said, "I have never heard anyone defend conscription for the sake of conscription. Rather, it was maintained after the war because politicians could see no other way of meeting immediate military needs." The matter was not, in any case, at the centre of post-war political debates. Discussion, such as it was, revolved around the length of service rather than its necessity. And just as conscripts gritted their teeth and said, 2 years to push, so politicians made national service palatable, partly by insisting that it was a temporary measure, one that was never, at any particular moment, underwritten by legislation, designed to last for more than 5 years. So peacetime conscription, as I said previously, is pretty unique in Britain and almost certainly not part of overall British military policy. In Europe, compulsory military service was pretty much baked into most modern European states, but the sea had been the key to Britain's defences. Land armies that developed in 19th century Europe were necessary in Britain. Britain had always had a small volunteer force, a professional army, the British Expeditionary Force of 1914, for example. And at times of national crisis, it was able to recruit far larger bodies of men. When the British did fight on land, they often did so by, from the Napoleonic Wars onwards, by subsidising local forces, by paying for European armies in Europe to operate, or arming or equipping them. Or sometimes using the empire to recruit local troops, such as sepoys in India. The whole point of the British Army is it's meant to be small, and it was made up in large measure of long-serving soldiers, professional soldiers that knew the business of fighting. The Richard Vinen writes, "Far from being the people in arms, the British Army consisted of men drawn from a distinct section of society, usually the poorest, sometimes who'd spent years serving in the remote garrisons overseas, especially in India. Respectable people often regarded soldiers with horror. When William Robertson, the first man in the British history to rise from the rank of private to that of field marshal, abandoned his position as a domestic servant to enlist as a private, his mother allegedly wrote, 'I would rather bury you than see you in a red coat.'" So there were all sorts of ideas, particularly about social class and respectability and aspiration, that were incorporated into soldierly life and incorporated into the ideas of it being a sort of a slightly subversive idea and being sort of slightly associated with society's lower orders. So conscription didn't begin during the Boer War, from 1899 to 1902, but it was the aftermath of the Boer War that made the difference. Politicians, retired army officers, and the those who had witnessed Britain's relatively mediocre performance in South Africa founded the National Service League. The League argued that Germany was the key threat to Great Britain. The Kaiser's various inopportune comments over South Africa had raised this suspicion and fear, along with the growing naval rivalries that were developing between Britain and Germany. And there was a fear that the level of fitness required to take on a European rival like Germany did not exist amongst young British men. Instead, there needed to be some kind of national compulsory training, and only a few months of this would be full-time, and this would mean that there would be a reserve army of young men ready to fight if and when Germany invaded. There were all sorts of anxieties and fears. I've talked about this previously when I talked about the development of Britain's secret services. In the first decade of the 20th century, about the possibility of a German invasion. There were various kind of crime novels, such as Erskine Childers, or spy novels like Erskine Childers' Riddle of the Sands, and the various John Buchan novels, that presented this as a realistic possibility. And so culture and reality sort of played off one another to create this heightened sense of anxiety. And there was a fear that Britain wasn't really ready for it. And it's interesting that the Boer War produces this culture. At the same time, it's producing many of the arguments for the modern welfare state, that deficiency diseases were so rife among young British men from working class backgrounds that they had to be turned away from recruiting stations. The League in 1905 became more dynamic when Lord Roberts, who had retired as Commander-in-Chief of the British Army, began to take charge of it. And Leo Amery, one of Churchill's good friends, who was a rising star within the Conservative Party, became its secretary. So the League managed to access itself plenty of funding, and by 1913 it had a membership of almost 100,000. But even this large membership base, and even this leadership, and even this organisation, didn't have any impact on contemporary political debates about conscription. There was nobody interested in introducing peacetime conscription whatsoever. Of course, during the First World War, Britain does manage to recruit a large volunteer army, and conscription wasn't required until 1916. The point A.J.P. Taylor makes about conscription in 1916 is that it was largely based around kind of various hoo-has created in the Daily Mail. That by 1916, Britain didn't need conscription because it had already an abundance of volunteers. It had more volunteers than it could actually train. This is the year of the Battle of the Somme, which tells you something about popular attitudes towards the war. And the Daily Mail was really trying to create some kind of manufactured controversy to excite its readers about those who were shirking, not doing their bit. It is the conscription that divides the Liberal government at the time, and the instincts of some members of the party are to go with conscription because it seems to be a popular measure. Whereas Asquith himself saw it as a profoundly illiberal thing to do. So, Richard Vianen writes, "During the First World War, Britain raised a large army, but conscription was not introduced until 1916. Indeed, in some ways, deliberate direction of manpower, the word itself was coined during the war, was about keeping men out of the army as much as getting them in, because the voluntary recruitment campaigns that took place in the war had stripped factories of their workers. Sir Auckland Geddes, later of Geddes Axe fame, a member of the National Service League and the First Minister of National Service, later suggested that the main function of such a ministry should be to prevent the militant and pugnacious young men of the country flocking in excessive numbers into the fighting services to the detriment of essential civilian activities." So the Churchill government during the Second World War made sure that there were reserved occupations that men and women were kept to reserved occupations that prevented them from going to the...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Front line, and these were things such as train drivers, coal miners, teachers, and doctors, the kind of stuff that would keep the country actually going. So in the 1920s and 30s, conscription is barely discussed in Britain. Germany obviously had no conscription at this time. Germany had an army of 100,000, and there was no clear military threat to Britain. Charles de Gaulle in France published a book in 1934 called Towards the Professional Army, or Vers l'Army de Métier. And it was scandalous in France because it called for the professionalisation of the army, which was seen as an anti-democratic measure, the idea that the army could be taken out of the people's hands, that the kind of conscription was no longer necessary, was actually seen as a fundamentally bad thing. A professional army in Britain was just simply a given, taken for granted. The sizes of the British army were limited by the state of public finances from 1929 to about 1934. Obviously, public finances are in a terrible crisis. During this time, shipbuilding goes into radical decline. And through this sense that the army was really the last resort for otherwise unemployable men, there was nothing really contributed to the esteem of the armed forces, other than it being seen as a kind of a glorified dole queue. So during the 1930s, there were men who preferred to spend their days in poverty than actually take up a military uniform and get fed. The army seems a particularly unattractive place to go. There was opposition to conscription came from three areas. The first was nationalism. Irish nationalists resented the idea that they might be required to fight for the British Empire. There were large numbers of Irishmen who volunteered for the British Army in both World Wars. However, the government was very, very reluctant to introduce conscription in Ireland, and even during the First World War. The second was probably a more powerful force, was liberalism. The Liberal Party objected to any restriction on individual freedom and the growth of the state in this regard. And the third was socialism. The argument that military service was a kind of democratic, this French idea, or even that the military service was revolutionary, that only really works in a country where there's been a revolution like the French Revolution. And this idea counts for very little in Britain, where the army is tied up with ideas of class, service, and deference, and kind of still is, really. The Labour Party was objected to militarism of any sort, and then particularly after the First World War, when it had been the popular idea of the working classes going over the top, had been such a kind of a radical force changing the debate regarding national service and shifting that debate to the left, and seeing national service as really kind of almost class exploitation, that there was very little scope for these kinds of debates during the 1920s and 30s. Labour politicians were afraid of the possibility of industrial conscription, that workers might be forced to work under government control in factories, or that military discipline might even be used to break strikes, that they might be seen also as not in the national interest and against the interests of the state in peace or war. And generally, it made certain democratic politicians feel very nervous, the idea of there being a kind of a large peacetime army around to do whatever the government instructed it to do. The left of the Labour Party had complicated relations with the army during the 1930s, because on the one hand, there were those who worried about a more authoritarian government breaking democratic norms in Great Britain. But also, there was a belief that that rapid rearmament should happen because of the threat of Nazism. When Nazi Germany eventually brought about conscription in April 1939, Neville Chamberlain introduced the Military Training Act, which made it required all men aged 20 to 22 to undergo 6 months of training as militiamen. This was opposed by the Labour Party. In September that year, there was no opposition when the government brought out the National Service Act, which conscripted men between 18 and 41 to register for military service. And this passed through all three stages in one day, on the 3rd of September 1939. So this was extended in 1942 to take men up to the age of 50 and then married and childless women between the ages of 18 and 30. So that's where are the kind of the post-war traditions of military service that lasted into the 1960s emerged from. National service extended beyond military service. There were the Bevan boys, the men who went down the coal mines to run the coal mines during the war. Men of military age worked in war industries and could actually be forbidden from taking their place in the armed services. And the Queen, Princess Elizabeth herself at the time, and now Queen, much to the kind of the shock of some of the members of court, was required to register at the age of 18 and join the Women's Army Corps, where she learned to mend Land Rovers. It's been a skill that served her throughout her life. And at this phase, conscription is pretty uncontroversial. A country that has been bombed by Nazi Germany, that has seen off the threat of invasion, is more likely to take the need for mass military service pretty seriously. At the end of the war, British generals and politicians began to discuss with one another about the continuation of the policy. Abolition would have been difficult when there were British servicemen all over the world. It's difficult to simply just say come home when there are troops in place. They're normally there for a reason. They're normally carrying out operations, be it not necessarily against Germany, Japan or Italy, but as the war has ended, against the new realities that confront them far more kind of complex situations, and to carrying out sort of, I suppose you call, police actions, which is British troops were required really to act as a kind of like a gendarmerie in areas that Britain had fallen under Britain's control during the war. These range from Java and Sumatra to Vietnam. There were British soldiers, of course, all over Europe. The various different roles that the British soldiers took part in was exacerbated as it would appear that India was about to become independent. And from 1945 onwards, the Army of India can't really be relied on anymore because it simply refuses to carry out the colonial policing work that the British want due to the various kind of crises and politics of the war. The British maintained contacts with, for example, the Gurkha regiments in Nepal, and used POWs from Germany and Japan and Italy to provide years of free labour after the end of the fighting. There were Poles that remained with the British Army until 1949, and the British government did consider creating a foreign legion, which would recruit from the various dispossessed and the various stateless young men in Europe who had fled communism and or Nazism. However, the real answer, as far as British politicians were concerned, this real kind of answer to this growing, this looming manpower crisis, was to create national service. When Labour won the general election, it was a landslide victory in 1945, which was a terrible shock to many of the Conservatives. The election was fought on questions of housing, of healthcare, of building a new welfare state. It wasn't fought on the issue of national service. And it was won in many ways by the vote from overseas working class soldiers, the military postal vote. And many of them did not anticipate that military service would continue for over a decade longer than the end of the Second World War itself. And this itself would be a kind of a powerful theme within British society after the end of the war. The British society would continue to be a society in part based around militarism post-war. Anyway, I'm going to finish there. I hope you find this useful. We've got a special treat for you guys next week. I'll be reviewing Dark Shadows by Joanna Lillis. Joanna Lillis is a journalist in Central Asia who writes for The Guardian, The Economist and Eurasia Net. We'll be chatting about her new book. We'll be chatting about the politics of Kazakhstan and the experience of writing and reporting from this very, very poorly understood part of Central Asia and the former Soviet Union. So look forward to that. There you go, my Christmas treat to you all. And I'll catch you this time next week. Thanks, all the best. Bye-bye.